Welcome to the first shiur on Pilegesh Begira. Before starting the shiur, I'd just like to mention that there's a special notebook that we're using for this section of the three prakim of Pilegesh Begira. For those listening to the recording, this can be found on the website a little further to the right. It's downloadable as a PDF, and it will be helped to facilitate the learning throughout the next few weeks. If you take a look at the notebook, you'll see that the notebook is divided into a few sections. There's a table of contents on the front, and also notably on the front is a picture, which is a little hard to see, but it's a picture of a dark forest with some light shining through a clearing in the front. The symbolism of this, and this is important as we're about to begin this section, is that Pilegesh Begira is one of the lowest points in Jewish history, and the history of the nation of Israel up till this point, and is very much the capstone of a terrible era, the end of Sefer Shoftim in many ways, a very dark period. However, as we study it, and as we go through it, we'll notice that there are many little pieces of light, little glimmers that shine through the darkness of this period, which is what we're going to try to focus on, while also at the same time trying to fathom the depth of the tragedy. Also, just the picture does have another hint to it, and that is the picture of the forest. The forest will be a noteworthy image as we near the end of the story. Something to keep in mind. I'll let the audience think about that as we go along. Focusing back on the book, you'll notice that the book, the first 12 pages in the source book, are actually the prakim, the three chapters which describe this. These are chapters 19, 20, and 21 in Sefer Shoftim, Perek Yotes, Chof and Chof Alev. And they're there with English till page 12. Following from page 12, we effectively have three iyunim, three major discussions outside of the realm of the text itself, in the later and the earlier Mefarshim, of understanding three discussions. Number one, iyun one is the Stom parallel, the parallel to the incident of Stom, which we read in Parshas Vayera. Number two will be the civil war and its theological implications, trying to understand what went on in the second of the Prakim of Pilegesh Begira. And finally, the third iyun is the aftermath of this event. And finally, on the last page of the book, you'll be able to see on pages 20 and 21, two maps from Da'at Mikra, which actually help see in a greater dimensional plane of what was actually occurring during the event and the following war. So, as we're about to begin, again, just an emphasis that unlike many of the other things that we'll be learning together in Nach, the story of Pilegesh Begira is one which we may not be able to answer all the questions. There's depravity to the extent that even though we may be able to apply reasoning, try to be able to understand things, there are going to be certain things that we're not going to be able to understand the depth of the depravity. And I say that as we enter, because we should remember that this story is a story which is going to be quoted and requoted throughout the centuries as the paradigm, as the epitome of anarchy and depravity civilly among the nation of Israel themselves. And it really bears with it the hallmark of the lowest point of the nation of Israel. So there's a lot of things we're not going to necessarily be able to address to the fullest fathomable extent. When I first studied this with my teacher, Rabbi Chaim Angel, he described interestingly how he was once on a train going between Washington, D.C. and New York. And he was sitting on the train, and he had an empty seat next to him. Suddenly he sits down beside him and says, "Oh, I can't help noticing, but you're Jewish." It's always an interesting way of to begin a conversation. And he happened to have open in front of him the story of Pilegesh Begira. He was studying Pilegesh Begira in Sefer Shoftim. And the person said to him, "Is this Torah?" And he explained, "No, really, this is, you know, there's a tripartite division, this is Nevi'im, this is the second section." He says, "Oh, what's it about?" So he turned to him and said, "Well, do you really want to know?" He said, "Sure." So he explained to him. He told him the terrible incident of Pilegesh Begira. He told him the theological significance of it, the importance of it coming as the capstone of Sefer Shoftim, an introduction to Sefer Shmuel. And they had a long conversation about it. And the person was extremely enthused. The person was incredibly amazed about the whole description of the events, or what could have been, what it was otherwise just a terrible event, and understanding the depth of what it meant. And then he got off at Pittsburgh, and somebody else walked into the train, sat down next to him, and looked at him and said, "I can't help noticing you're Jewish, but is that Torah?" And the exact same conversation ensued all the way to New York. So it's very interesting. There's a lot of things we can gain through this. And with that, I'd like to begin the story of the Pelegish Begira. So starting on the first page, this is Perek Yotes and Shoftim. It says, Vayhi bayomim ahem. It was in those days. Umelech en b'Yisrael. There was no king in Israel. Again, this is the refrain we've seen as we're coming out of the section of Pesel Micha, that Umelech en b'Yisrael, there is no king. There is no ruler. There is nobody over here to govern the nation of Israel, to create some form of system of justice. And that's perhaps a commentary on how these events could actually occur, how Pesel Micha could occur, how Pelegish Begira could occur, why Umelech en b'Yisrael. There is no king in Israel. Vayhi ish Levi, and there was a man from Levi, Gor b'Yarkasei Har Ephraim, who dwelt in the depths of the far side of Har Ephraim, mountains of Ephraim. Vaykach lo isha pilegesh, and he took for himself a woman who would be a pilegesh, which is one of those words which is often one of those English words which a third grader may know but have no idea what it means, a concubine. So he took himself a concubine. We're going to see in a moment what that means. Mibes Lechem Yehuda, from Bethlehem, from Beis Lechem Yehuda. Now, we'll notice, of course, that there's no timing. There's no date to the story. That's the most important thing at the moment, is there's no date to the story. The story could have occurred anywhere. We're not going to focus on that right now, because when we finished Pesel Micha, we described a lot of we spent a lot of time describing the dating of Pesel Micha, which follows suit to Pelegish Begira. The two major approaches we saw was the Radak, that it occurs in the period between Shimshon and Eli. And this is a period of anarchy where there is no leader, whereas Rashi, following the Seder Olam, the Midrash of Seder Olam, understands that it occurred much earlier in Sefer Shoftim, actually near the beginning. Beit Hazmei still left as the last story, and is the last taste in our mouths as we leave Sefer Shoftim, for all the significant points that it is left as such. However, what we do notice is that already there are parallels being set up for us to many different stories, and the one is simply the story of Pesel Micha, which just precedes it. First of all, we have an Ish Levi. Again, we have an anonymous Ish Levi at least at the beginning. As we know, we had an Ish Levi as well in the story of Pesel Micha, a wandering Levi. In that story, he came from Beis Lechem Yehuda. In this story, this Ish Levi marries a woman from the Beis Lechem Yehuda. Interesting parallel. And finally, also B'Yarkasei Har Ephraim. He lives in the depths of Har Ephraim. Har Ephraim is the context, is the land which Pesel Micha occurred. So we have three parallels to the previous story, and we're going to have to work out why Tanakh frames this story of Pelegish Begira within the same words, or at least in the same context as the story of Pesel Micha. What's the connection between the two of them? That's point number one. Point number two is really to understand what this idea of Pelegish is. There's a great history to this, but it's important to understand it to be able to understand the context of the story and also to understand the relationship between this man and his Pelegish. So if for a moment you'll turn a little later on the booklets to page 12, you know, there is a discussion on page 12, this is the earlier Rishonim, discuss what in fact a Pelegish is. This is one of the first times the Torah mentions the concept of Pelegesh, to be found in Parshas Chaye Sarah, where it talks about Avraham sending away the Bnei Pilagshim, the children of his Pilagshim, or his concubines. Right over there, Rashi and the Ramban discuss what is the concept of Pelegesh. So starting from the middle of the page, in the box, Rashi says, HaPilagshim, Chaser Ksiv, it is written Chaser, meaning without a yud near the end, to imply that it's lacking a really a plural. It's not really the sons of many concubines, but rather one. Shelohoisa ela Pelegesh Achas. Because Avram really only had one Pelegesh, one concubine. He Hagar, he Keturah. This is Hagar, this is Keturah. In an academic way of describing, this is what's called a closed canon association, which means to say that there is an unknown. There's an unknown person, Keturah, in the Tanakh. We don't know anything about her. Rashi is associating her with somebody we do know, which is Hagar. Fine. So Hagar is Keturah, and she is the Pelegesh. And here's the point which is of significance to our story. Nashim Viksuba, women, or when you use the word Isha as a technical term, not just to describe a female, it means that woman is married with a Ksuba, with a document of security at marriage, that should there be a divorce or widowing, chas v'shalom. In such a case, the husband or his inheritors will pay the woman or her inheritors a certain amount, a significant amount. That's something which is a safeguard, a security to their marriage, that it can't be dropped at a whim. It's something of serious note on all levels, even financially. And finally, pilagshim v'loiksuba. But pilagshim do not have that security. It sounds like some type of marriage, but a marriage without necessarily having iksuba. A lower type, a wedding with a marriage with some lower form of security. And he brings a proof from the Gemara in Sanhedrin that it is such, that really a pilagish is married, just she simply doesn't have the security of the iksuba. The Ramban, on the same pasuk, actually argues. And going down the next box, the Rashi costs of Nashim b'ksuba pilagshim b'loksuba, kudama b'nashim b'pilagshim d'davim b'sanhedrin. He quotes that Rashi says that woman, or when you use the technical term isha, it is with a ksuba, and a pilagish is without a ksuba. V'ein hadavokein, and the matter is not, simply not so. Ki, lo tikra pilagish ela keshihi b'lo kiddushim. You only call a pilagish a lady who has no kiddushim, who is not actually technically married to the man in the first place. Because the concept of ksuba, the law of ksuba, is actually from the word rabbis. It is of rabbinical origin. It is not a law from the Torah. This is significant because Rashi and the Ramban actually argue whether a ksuba is in the Torah or not. The Ramban, who understands that a ksuba is not a Torah-ordained or biblically ordained law, therefore understand that that cannot obviously be the difference to a description of the Torah itself of the Pilegesh and Anisha. Rather, it must be that there's no marriage at all. And he has a different text in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which refutes Rashi's proof. It's possible that when Noachides would marry women, as in their law, which would be through a relationship, they would write to them a certain amount of money. That would be the regular protocol of a marriage, that when people were to marry, they would, the man would set aside money to the woman. And when a person would decide to have a relationship with a woman, but he would be able to send her away without when he would want, and her children were not to be part of his inheritance, he would not write for them anything. And that would be a pilegish. It's not even a marriage. Valdasar was saying shehi hagar, and then he goes on to say that keturah is hagar, like Rashi says. Fantastic. So what comes out of here is an interesting point, is that halachically, is a pilegish married to the person or not? Rashi understands, of course they're married, it's just simply they don't have the security of the ksuba, whereas the Ramban understands that no, they aren't even married in the first place. It's below kiddushim. When the shiur was given actually live, and a number of the ladies asked, and this is a very good point to bring up, is why is it that, according to the Ramban, that there's not really a marriage, is such a thing allowed? Are people allowed to just have a relationship and without any form of responsibility? Is this the way it's supposed to work? And in response to that, it really goes into, and this is a little bit of a tangent, but it's important to come back to our story, is how to understand there is a particular issur in the Torah of Kedesha. The Torah tells us in Parshas Kisetze, Loisia Kedesha Bivnos Israel, there should not be a Kedesha among the daughters of Israel. And similarly, Loye Kodesh Bivnei Israel, there should not be a Kodesh, which is a man of a similar nature. What is a Kedesha? And there's a discussion in the Mefarshim, what is a Kedesha? Rashi understands that it means to say a woman set aside specifically for illicit activity, a prostitute, effectively. And a number of the Mefarshim take that approach. However, the Rambam, in a number of places, one appearing in Hilchos Nashim, in Ishus Perek Aleph Halacha Dalad, and later on in Melachim Perek Dalad as well, the Rambam describes that in fact before Matan Torah, before the Torah was given, in general the way it would work was if a person met a woman, they would if they both wanted to, he would give her some money and they would have a relationship and that would be it. And there wouldn't necessarily be any type form of continued union or form of later responsibility to that relationship. However, once the Torah was given, then the Kedesha was Ne'esar, which means that when the Torah tells us, Lo yetzia kedesha b'binos Yisrael, that means to say that unless there is a physical relationship in the context of marriage, that would be fall under the Isser of Kedesha. That means to say, unmarried girls, women who might be called a Pilegesh, all of that, according to the Rambam, is under the rubric of Lo yetzia kedesha b'binos Yisrael. There shouldn't be this Kedesha. The only context for physical relationship is within marriage, says the Rambam. The Rambam understands this, and therefore, he has to address, how is that Avraham Avinu, how is that Yaakov Avinu had Pilag Shim? How could they, if this is true, have Pilag Shim? And he explains that this is only before the Torah was given. It's also noteworthy to point out that later on we do see David HaMelech has Pilag Shim, Gideon has a Pilag Shim, it seems. And the Rambam explains in Melachim that over there, a king is different. A king is allowed a Pilegesh because nobody is allowed to have any relationship with the wife or a Pilegesh of the king. And therefore, in a certain sense, even though it's a Pilegesh, the union has a longer lasting value, because obviously nobody can have a relationship with that woman. It's almost as if it's a regular marriage. But for a regular person, after Matan Torah, a Pilegesh is Aser. A Pilegesh is not allowed. So, coming back to our story here for a moment, these are just background details to understanding the story of this Pilegesh Begiva over here. According to Rashi, really effectively this is a marriage over here without some form of security, so a lower level of marriage. According to the Ramban, this is not even a marriage. But interestingly, and perhaps most significantly for the reflection on our story, is according to the Rambam, this wasn't even allowed perhaps. The Radvaz, one of the Pirushim on the Rambam later on in Melachim, suggests that maybe it was allowed, but just at this point in time, Klal Yisrael, the whole of the body of Israel, had not accepted or weren't in practice of this Lo Yetzia Kedesha, which is a hard concept to think about. It's hard to understand that the whole of Klal Yisrael throughout a period would not be practicing a certain extent of a mitzvah from the Torah. But that perhaps is exactly the point over here. Perhaps this is a commentary on the time. Perhaps it's a commentary on the time that either we're talking about people or a person who's doing something which is prohibited. In fact, this is not a relationship which is meant to be. Or that the whole of Israel at this point in time is not being careful about this particular mitzvah through the eyes of the Rambam and the Radvaz when looking at this. Be it as it may, it's important to bear these in mind, to think through these lenses as we go on through the story, to see the level of responsibility of this husband to his wife, and also to understand if, in addition to all the things that are going to happen to this lady, whether the adultery is also among them. Because according to the Ramban, adultery may not be part of that list, seeing as there wasn't even a marriage as well. This doesn't detract from any of the other horrific and terrible things that occur. But adultery wouldn't be an aspect of that. Therefore, there's a lack of liability for death on that path as well. These are things to keep in mind as we go out through as we continue through this parasha. Continuing in the meantime, we're going to be moving on to Pasuk Beis. This is back on page 1. But Tizne Olav Pilagsham, his Pilagesh was Mezane on him. Mezane on him. Now, if we're to translate that literally as it's done in the Mechon Mamre translation, which we have over here, this means to say that she played harlot, as they described. That means to say that, in a certain sense, there was an infidelity, that it sounds like she had a relationship with somebody else. And Vatelech Meito El Beis Avio, and she went from him and back to her father's house, El Beis Lechem Yehuda to Bethlehem, Vatehi Sham Yomim Arba Chodeshim, she was there for 4 months. Okay, so that's one possibility of what it could mean on the most literal translation, which one Pirush in the Radak does adopt, but most of the Meforshim do not adopt this. And understand that really over here, we're not talking about an adultery of any sort. We're talking about an argument, a spat which occurred between them. Obviously, he must have said something horrible. She must have said something horrible back. There was something which went on between the two of them. She, in pain, ran back to her father's house. Why did the Mepharshim deviate from the literal understanding? This is Rashi, the Ralbag, the first understanding in the Radak. Why do they deviate from the literal understanding that there was a znus over here, that there was an adultery? Simply because in the next pasuk, as we go on, vayokom isha vayelech achareha, ledaber el bo. Because we know in the next pasuk that the husband comes to try to bring her back. Now, to understand this halachically, in the realm of halacha, a person who, in the case of adultery, the wife cannot come back to her husband. That relationship cannot be reunified again. It's just it's simply so. So there is nothing to discuss about him coming back and trying to bridge that relationship. That's what leads most of the Mefarshim to understand, that there was just an argument over here, where she comes back to speaks to her heart to be able to try to resolve that argument, to resolve that issue that they had between them. However, again, just as a footnote, it is important to understand that if we're talking about a Pilegesh who isn't fully married, like the opinion of the Ramban, then it could have been real adultery, but it doesn't necessarily affect their ability to get back together again. And that's what the Radak adds in at the end of his second understanding. So moving on to Pasuk Gimel in full, Vayakam Isha, her husband got up, Vayelech Acharei, and he went after her, Ledaber Libo, to speak to her heart, Lahashiva, to return her, V'na'ara Imoi, and the man walks with his young lad, V'tzemed Chamorim, and a couple of donkeys, V'tivieu Beis Avira, and he brings her to her father's house, V'yirehu Aviha Na'ara, and the father of the girl sees her, V'yismach Likrosa, and he rejoices to see him. He rejoices to see his son-in-law coming back. Interesting things to think about in this pasuk. Number one is that the father-in-law is happy to see him again. This could be an altruistic happiness. Or it could be a happiness that he really wanted the two of them to be married. He wanted this to work. It pained him that there was a separation between the two of them. This should remain in our heads as a dramatic irony. This father-in-law loves his daughter, as we're going to see. He loves them being together so much. And that's why it's so tragic that that this person who loves his son-in-law and his daughter so much is going to watch, or perhaps even facilitate, as we may see, in the tragedy which is going to befall them later on. Number two, another thing to note and take note of in this pasuk, and this the Radak points out, is that in this pasuk there's actually a kri uksiv. That means to say that one word is read in a way in which it's not in the same way that it's actually printed or written on the cloth on the parchments. You'll notice that in the actual text over here, Lahashivoi ends with a vav, meaning to literally return him is how it's written. But Lahashiva is how you say it, and it's return her. The Radak points out that in a relationship, in rebuilding a relationship which has issues, there need to be two directions. On the one hand, it needs to be l'hashiva, he needs to bring himself back. And the second point is l'hashiva, to bring her back to him. There needs to be movement on the side of both parties in order to be able to fix this. That's what the Radak points out over here, l'hashiva, to bring himself back to her, l'hashiva, to bring her back to him. Those are the two steps taken in this pasuk as the man tries to bridge his relationship. We move further. Pasuk Dalet. V'yechazek bo chosna avi anara. And the father-in-law takes his son-in-law, Vayeshev Itzvan Yamim Shlosh, and he stays with him for 3 days. Vayachlu Vayishtu Vayalinu Sham, and they stay there for 3 days, and they drink and they eat, they stay there. Wonderful. Another thing, just to go back to the previous pasuk in Pasuk Gimel, we notice that the father-in-law is very happy for them to be here. He's happy to make this party. It's something wonderful. So on the one hand, as we just said, it could be this altruistic happiness, but on the other hand, there's something else to think about. And that is that maybe it's because, and the Ralbag points this out, is that maybe the Ish Levi, who we don't know, we're not told his name, is somebody of stature, a person who has who stands head and shoulders above other people in society, and he's so happy because it's a respect that this man comes back to marry his daughter, which again will now enlarge the tragedy which we're about to see, because if somebody of such great stature in the nation of Israel. At this time, the way he acts is going to be a lot to be left desired. There's not going to be any heroes in the story, and so therefore it adds to the tragedy. If, as the Ralbag is saying, this is a man, a high up man in society. We move to pasuk hey. Vayehi bayom haravi'i, it was on the fourth day. Vayashkima baboker. Vayakom lo leches. They get up in the morning. He wants to go get going. The father-in-law says to his son-in-law, Sa'ad libcha, feast your heart, pas lechem, bread, v'achar talecho, and afterwards you should go. He really wants them to stay. V'yeshu v'yachlu shneihem yachtav, and they both stayed and eat, v'yishru, and they drank, v'yomer avya naro al yish, and the father then said to the man, Ho'el nov lin v'yitav libech, please stay. Stay over and make your heart merry. Notice the word na appearing over here. Na is a pleading word, and na is also a word that bears urgency now. There's two aspects to it. He's asking him, please stay. We continue. In Pasuk Zayin, Vayokom Ish Lo Leches, the man gets up to go. He doesn't want to stay. It's the end of the day. Vayivtzar Bo Chosno. His father-in-law put a lot of pressure on him. He urges him. Vayoshev Vayaran Sham, and he returns and he stays there. The word na, the word Vayivtzar Bo, that he urged him, these two words actually appear, as we're going to see, and we're going to discuss this in greater depth in the coming Shirim. Those words appear in the context of Lot, turning to the angels who visit him in Sodom, in Parshas Vayera, as he turns to them and he urges them, Surna, please turn. Vayivtzar bom not ma'od. Lot puts a lot of pressure on them to stay. It's interesting, thinking about the parallel, the safe haven. Lot saying, come to me, stay in my safe haven. This, the father-in-law prophetically saying, stay in my safe haven, don't leave. Interesting parallel that Shmuel HaNavi is using over here when using these words to describe this. Moving on to Pasuk Ches. Vayashkim HaBoker B'machamishi, on the fifth day, he got up in the morning. Notice it's not Vayashkimu, not the girl as well, interestingly. Not sure what to do with that. Only the man gets up early in the morning, and he gets Vayomer Avi Anara Asad Na Levavcha, feast to your heart, V'hisma Mehuru Ad Natos Hayom. And then and wait until the day at the end of the day, and they both ate. What's missing in this pasuk? What are they not doing on the fifth day that they were doing on the fourth day? The Malbim points out that the man is not drinking. It's clear already from the beginning of the day that he has no intention of staying here longer. He's not going to be confused at the end of the feast, like he was the previous day because he was drinking and have to stay. He's eating only now as a brunch. And remember, this is not breakfast. They didn't have breakfast in those days. We're talking about a near to the middle of the day meal. So he is only having the meal. It's clear the intentions are already to leave. In Pasuk Tes, Vayogom Ish Lo Leches, the man gets up to the walk. Hu Upilag Shov Anaro, his Pilegesh, and his lad. And again, his father-in-law says, "Hineinah rofo hayom la'arov." The day has become weak, as it is going to set. Linu na, again, please stay. Hineicha nosayom. The day is ending. Lin po v'yitav levavecha. Stay here and may feast to your heart's desire. V'shkamtem achol adarkechem. And tomorrow you will get up and go on your way. V'olachta lo alecha, and you'll go to your tent. It is interesting, and it is very sad, over here that this man, the father of the girl, loves his daughter and his son-in-law so much, it pains him terribly to see them go. It makes me think of the Shmini Atzeres parallel, of Hashem saying to Bnei Yisrael in the Medrash, which is quoted in Rashi at the end of Parshas Pinchas, that, Kosher Olai Pred Aschem, it's hard for me to see you leave. Stay one more day. That's what it sounds like, this endeared father really wanting his children to stay, which makes it all the much more tragic to us, the reader, knowing that this is not going to end in any form. He hates to see them go, and that makes it more all the more tragic, when ultimately his tarrying, his making them stay, is perhaps part of the reason that they are going to be late and have to stay in a place which is foreign. We go move on to Pasuk Yud. V'lova ishlalun v'yakom v'yelech v'yavo ad nochach Yevus. And they walk in the direction of Yevus, which is a town, Jebusite town, on the borders of Jerusalem. He Yerushalayim. Because although Yerushalayim was captured in some parts, this depends on how you read Yeshua and Shoftim earlier on, but parts of Yerushalayim were captured, but the cities around were controlled, and they were called Yevus, owned by the Jebusites. V'imo, and with him Tzemed Chamorim, his couple of donkeys, Chavushim, bearing their loads, Upilag Shor Imoy, and his Pilegesh was with him. Heimim Yevus. They were just by Yevus. Vayom Radmo, or the day is really near the end. Vayomer Hanar El Adonov, and the lad says to his master, L'chono Vasura, V'nosura El Ira Yevusia Zos, V'nolimbo. Let's go to this Jebusite city and stay here, because at the end of the day, we have to go in. It's better than being in the field. Question. Let's not go to a non-Jewish, a non-Israelite city. Vavarnu ara Givah. Let's try to get to Givah, which is a city in Binyamin. Vayomel Naro. And he said to his lad, "Lechov nikruva ba'achad amekomos v'lanu ba'givah or ba'ramah. Let's try to get to one of these places and stay in Givah or Ramah." Vayavru vayalechu, and they carried on walking. Vatavo lohem hashemesh eitzel givah shel Binyamin, and they got to Givah, which is by Binyamin. Just understand what's going on over here, actually, on the map itself. If you wouldn't mind, just for a moment, turning to page 20. This is the map. This is map number one. You'll notice on page 20. That in the center, near the bottom, is the area of Yehuda, where you see Beis Lechem, Bethlehem. And there is a line leading up northwards, all the way through the center of the page, all the way to the top, Shiloh, which is where they're heading in Har Ephraim, whereas Har Ephraim is circular among the mountains on the top of the page. And as you walk from that line, from Beis Lechem all the way up, you'll see Yevus. That's where Yerushalayim is, that's on the way northwards. But just a little further than it is Givah and Ramah. So he's trying to get beyond the non-Jewish city. He's trying to get beyond this city, and you can see just in context of what it is today, on the map, it's put on where Neve Yaakov is today. That's really very close to where Givah is, just to give you an idea of where they're walking. So they carry on walking, and they arrive at Givah, which is in the city, in this tribe of Binyamin, is written across the page. The question which is left in our minds, as we end this section, is the following. The question which is left in our minds is, was the man right? Was the Ishlevi right by saying that we shouldn't have gone to Yevus because it's not been a Yisrael Hema? They're not from among the Jews, as the Malbim points out. They weren't paying taxes. They're not a Jewish city, or they don't pay taxes to the Jews. We can't trust them. The question left in the reader's mind, as we're reading and we're being told about this, is: were they better off, or they're not better off? They go to the Giver. They go to the city of Binyamin, and they get the most atrocious treatment. And we have to question, who's better? Who's better? Would have been better to be in the Yevusi city? Would have been better to be among the Binyaminites? That's the question that's left in our minds. Very tragic question. We'll continue next time as we move into the actual story, the incident of Pelegish Begiva itself. Have a wonderful day.